This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
I'd like to welcome you to Two Old Heads with my co-compadre Mike Fenwick, and we'd like to welcome Chris McKelney, councillor for the SNP, who is one of the two people behind the Plan B thing that everyone's talking about.
Thanks, good to be here.
Hi Chris, welcome.
Hiya. Hi Mike.
There are certain people who know the Scotland Act inside out. They'll quote it to you and they'll tell you where you're going wrong if you say something. But to have a debate where Section 30 is involved, I think it's very important that we actually understand the process that's involved in it. It includes, first of all, reference, a request has to be made. But that request may go to the UK government, but it then descends into the Privy Council. Now, I don't know who is on the Privy Council. I don't know whether they all attend all the meetings. If you go onto Wikipedia and study it, it's a complex thing. After that's done and we've got the Queen's approval for it, and it has to be the Queen that approves it, it then has to be approved by the UK Parliament, including the House of Lords, as well as the House of Commons. Then and only then it comes to the Scottish Parliament, who can either approve it or disapprove it. It's a complicated process involving a whole bundle of people. The paper that will appear will show you part of that definition. And it's not Section 30. The funny thing is, it's Section 30, brackets 2, close brackets. I read small print and I read what the implications of these things are. Also mentions, and I'll finish in this, Schedule 4 of the Scotland Act and Schedule 5 of the Scotland Act. That's something I'll return to later in the discussion we're having. At the moment, Chris, however, over to you. It's your platform. I know you and Angus McNeill are now trying to contact or have contacted Mike Russell. Can you tell me where you are, what you're planning and what's involved in it, please?
Yeah, thanks very much. I think that was a pretty good preamble to where we're at. So I think if we just start for the semantics of the name. So Plan B, by definition, means that we're not asking for a brand new policy because we support Plan A. Our preference is to have a referendum just like we had in 2014, along the same lines that Alex Salmond managed to agree through the Edinburgh Agreement in 2012. So that's Plan A. Plan A is get the UK government to agree to that Section 30 order so that the power can temporarily be transferred to the Scottish Parliament so that we can have a referendum. And then on the result of a yes vote, we can then become an independent country. So that's Plan A. But obviously, we've got concerns that Plan A has stalled. And that's why we decided, well, we need a Plan B, because at the moment, Boris Johnson can effectively say no to every single request we make, and there's no political price for him to pay. He doesn't face the prospect of losing seats in Scotland because of it, because he doesn't actually need seats in Scotland. And even if that was the case, if you look at the Dominic Cummings affair, Boris Johnson was willing to throw the entire Tory party under the bus and ignore the views of an overwhelming majority of people in England to keep his man in office and risk his entire domestic agenda going forward purely to keep his man in office. So if you factor in that that's the behaviour of the man that we're relying on to be the bastion of democracy and respecting the democratic mandate of the people of Scotland, well, I think that's a flawed strategy. And that's why I think we need that Plan B. Plan B is the political tool to force Plan A to succeed. But if it doesn't succeed, then it's got a very likely success of its own at the election in 2021. So what we're asking for is that in the 2021 manifesto, so the SNP would again make clear to the people of Scotland that we've already got four, remember, mandates from the people of Scotland. We won the largest ever amount of votes in the 2016 Holyrood election at the constituency, the largest ever, over 1 million. And even our opponents were, and probably the most ardent of unionists was concede, it was pretty unambiguous that if people voted for the SNP, re-elected an SNP Scottish government, but then the people of Scotland were dragged out of the EU against their will just 1 month later. And again, the fact that there was a Brexit referendum only 1 month after the Scottish Parliament election, I think that again shows just how little respect the UK government showed the people of Scotland, and that we were supposed to enter into a referendum campaign only a month after we had been to the polls. But regardless, the people of Scotland were clear that Scotland was dragged out of the EU against their will, and that was a mandate, because that was a material change of circumstances, to have a referendum on Scottish independence. Then in 2017, the much-aligned media reported failure of the SNP. Of course, governments across the Western world would have been queuing up for a majority that the SNP won in 2017. So it was still a majority with a mandate to deliver an independence referendum. In 2019, at the EU elections, we won 50% of the seats, again with a clear pledge to people in Scotland that Scotland should stay in Europe and we should have a choice in our own future. And in 2019, well, it was completely overwhelming. There can be no doubts that people in Scotland went to the polls, cast their vote, for probably two reasons. The first being to stay in the EU, to stop Brexit, but importantly, to give Scotland a choice on their own future. So we've got all those mandates. So if we go to the polls in 2021 and our manifesto simply says, vote SNP for a choice in Scotland's future to ask for a Section 30 request. Well, we know already that back in 2017, Theresa May never even responded to the request for a Section 30 order. That's quite often revived out of history. That's perhaps even more contemptuous than Boris Johnson's outright refusal, that she never even responded to the request of the First Minister of Scotland's democratically elected government. And then in 2019, Boris Johnson batted out of the park. And obviously then the coronavirus overtook circumstances. So as we're starting to see pubs reopening, kids going back to school full-time, shops reopening. Now, over the last 3 months, and you'll appreciate at a local government level with all the levers that we're in charge of in terms of tackling the coronavirus, that has been where my focus has been. But for the wider independence movement and even the people I'm trying to talk to bring them over to vote yes, well, if I'm seeing that people can go to a beer garden and have a beer, go to a pub, go clothes shopping, go to the cinema, go to the theatre, well, why can we not then talk about Scotland's future and the democratic deficit of the people of Scotland being denied a choice in their own future? So I think it's now time for the SNP to get back on with proving that Plan A does work. Because if Plan A works, you don't need a Plan B. And I'll be the first person to line up and campaign and be happy if that's the case, because we'll have delivered the referendum. So to your point, that's why myself and Angus McNeill have written to Mike Russell, because, as I said, the First Minister's obviously busy working every day on the coronavirus, along with the Health Secretary. The Education Secretary is working hard every day to deliver education and kids going back to school. The Finance Secretary is working on finance. Well, Mike Russell is the Constitutional Secretary. So his day job, as well as representing his constituents, and his constituency in one of the most beautiful constituencies in Scotland across the water from me in Argyll, his day job in government is the Constitution. So we've asked Mike Russell to start pressing Scotland's claim to deliver the mandate that the people of Scotland have given four times that we should have a choice on our own future. Now, I'm under no doubt that Boris Johnson doesn't want us to have a choice. And why does he not want us to have a choice? And why would he want us to have a choice? Well, 54% recently have said they would vote for Scottish independence. So why would Boris Johnson want to give us a choice when he knows that on the back of the most disastrous track record in the whole world on the coronavirus, the public trust is gone. The arguments about the pound that were made in 2014, they're gone. The arguments to stay in the EU, well, they're certainly gone. And people in Scotland are actually seeing an increasingly xenophobic and racist regime overtaking the UK government. And I think that people in England are as radical as people in Scotland, but the institutions of the people in England have well and truly been overtaken by people that I don't think reflect the direction people in Scotland want to go. So what is the campaign for a no vote or Scotland staying in the UK now? Is it the Rule Britannia, the Union Jack, the kind of the nostalgia of the Queen? Well, I don't think people are going to line up to vote for those things. And I think one thing I would give Boris Johnson credit for, he's the Prime Minister. I mean, surprised a lot of people, but he clearly is a political operator in his operation, well, Dominic Cummings' operation. And he'll be, without a doubt, advising Boris Johnson that the last thing he wants to do on the back of the coronavirus, when he's waited his whole career in life to govern, is to enter into a campaign on Scottish independence, one that he might lose. I think he would lose, and one that would certainly mean he has to resign, being the Prime Minister that basically spent his entire tenure killing people and then breaking up the UK. So people that think that another SNP election win, so the fifth to give us a mandate, and I've not done off the top of my head, but that would be the 9th or 10th or maybe even 11th election victory in a row for the SNP. People think all of a sudden, under these circumstances, that Boris Johnson's going to just turn round and become a friend to Scottish democracy and give us a choice. I don't think so, particularly when there's no political price for him to pay in doing so. So that takes us on to the plan B. What is plan B? So we would fight that election saying that we're not asking for another mandate to the referendum because we've already got that. We're affirming that mandate and saying that there will be a referendum on Scottish independence. And it's our preference that that should happen in line with the Edinburgh Agreement that Alex Salmond managed to achieve for us in 2012. And of course, he achieved that on 45% of the vote when independence was a lot lower, whereas now independence is sitting at 54%. So that's our first preference. I think that that is the best way to have a definitive choice on our own future. But if we're faced with the real reality that the UK government aren't going to let that happen, then we need to make sure the UK government understand that if they refuse to give us a choice in our own future, there will be consequences. And that campaign has got to make sure the people of Scotland understand that that's a legitimate approach to take. So if we win that election, and the people of Scotland are telling us that, yep, you've won this election, now deliver us a referendum, but the UK government don't let us have that referendum, then we need that political tool to say, well, actually, the people of Scotland have also gave us a mandate that if you refuse, as we told them it was likely you would, then we should enter straight into independence negotiations with you. And then that moves the argument completely into a new position than it is now, when Boris Johnson simply just has to keep saying no, and every time we ask, he knows we say he'll say no, and we'll move the argument no further. Plan B moves the argument further. It moves us into a position that we can start building a popular consensus in Scotland behind the legitimacy of the people in Scotland determining their own future. And you hear people, I think not helpfully, people within our own movement comparing Plan B to Catalonia. Well, we can only have a referendum in Scotland if it's legal. Because returning off, I'm a councillor, so I know chief executives, they won't deliver a referendum, they won't man the polling places if it's not deemed legal. And of course, Scots law and English law are two separate matters that people seem to want to airbrush hundreds of years and centuries of history out of that equation for their argument. So there wouldn't be a referendum if it wasn't legal. So the false equivalence with Catalonia is not only offensive to the people in Catalonia who are struggling for their right to self-determination. It's not only offensive to the political prisoners who are shamefully still in jail in Catalonia, it's offensive to the SNP and independence activists up and down Scotland who have campaigned for years, since 2014, and for decades for many people, and one of the most civic and joyous movements to establish and restore Scotland's sovereignty. It's nothing like Catalonia. It certainly won't be seen as that. And if we can establish and we can make people in Scotland realise it's completely legitimate for them to determine their own future at a democratic ballot box, I think we'll bring people with us. And I think the people within our own party will soon come over and they'll certainly stop booing when they see people in the independence movement cheering on the prospect.
There's a heck of a lot to cover in that. I told you before we started recording, I'd scribbled down some notes. You fit the piano keys that I want to raise with you.
Okay.
Before I say anything, Dave, come on in. I know you've got stuff that you want to question Chris on.
Well, basically, we're going to be doing this poll after this programme goes out. But I'm also doing a couple of other ones just now on Twitter, to basically find out what people think Plan B is. Do you think it's a tool to be able to make Plan A work? Or do you think that it's a reason to have a referendum that's not set in stone the way the Edinburgh Agreement was? Or do you think it's, if you get a majority of seats in Holyrood at the next election, can you then declare independence on that? Or if you get a majority of the popular vote, would you declare independence on that? And I'm getting all sorts of different answers because people don't actually seem to realise what it is. And it's like Pete Wishart said last week, give me something to debate. And I believe Chris gave him some debate and then he blocked him on Twitter.
Not ideal. Of course, I've only been a councillor for nearly a decade, but I'm still deemed as younger according to some of the older heads in the party. But you're supposed to look up to these people for leadership, but at the end of the day, some of them perhaps could be doing away a campaign and how to, sorry, a tutorial on how to use social media, because it does come across as quite divisive sometimes, and I would only urge Pete to try and engage with the independence movement a bit better than he's doing at the moment. But he's entitled to his own opinion. But to the point of, well, what is the plan B? I suppose it's all of those things. And until the SNP have a debate at their conference to determine what the final policy position is, then it could be all of those things. So, for example, does plan B force Boris Johnson to agree to the Section 30 order? Well, the Whitehall civil servants, they'll be weighing that up. They'll be asking themselves, well, where do we fancy our chances here? Do we fancy our chances going down the Edinburgh Agreement route? Then they would be part of the franchise. They would perhaps be able to steer what a referendum would look like. Would they have a better opportunity to make an argument for Scotland staying in the UK, which, again, preaching to the converted, I don't think many of them exist, if any, at the moment. Or will they say, no, we're still not going down the referendum route? So let the Scots do what they want. And that was another interesting argument that Pete Wishart made, was well, what happens when the UK government block the Scottish Parliament election? And I thought, good, excellent. What better way to evidence to people in Scotland that what we've been trying to tell them for years and years, that the UK government runs roughshod over Scottish democracy, is when the UK government actually block the democratic election to the Scottish Parliament because they don't like a policy that one of the bona fide parties is proposing in that election. So,
and the United Nations, if they see the fact that it's been blocked, I watched the wee Ginger Douglight a couple of years ago, and East Kilbride, and he'd come up with all these different possibilities, and he said to use the 21 election would be the nuclear option at that time, and that was when everything else was on the table. But now it looks like it's the only one left. But I think for them to actually cancel the Scottish elections, I don't think the international community would take that anymore.
Yeah, so I mean, at the end of the day, what we need to achieve here is we need a policy, we need a strategy. Now, the First Minister is rightly getting praised at the moment for how she can handle the coronavirus, so it's very unfair of anyone in the independence movement to be criticising her, because she's got a whole team and she's got 120,000 party members that can be coming up with some of these ideas and campaigning for her, so that when the coronavirus hopefully soon starts to become less of a threat, she can then pick up the work that we've created for her. But plan B, it's got to have that debate. But I'm talking about the SNP. And of course, the elephant in the room is that the SNP has bought the political party of the independence movement. So in the 2021 election, there will be other parties standing in that election that are pro-independence.
I'm going to come on to that, Chris, in due course. Can I do something slightly dangerous? I'm going to throw you a curveball. The presumption is that if Boris Johnson is asked to say yes to the referendum, he'll say no. I'm going to give you it from a different perspective. Let's say he's sitting down with Dominic Cummings. I'll play Dominic Cummings for a few seconds and I say, Boris, you're going to lose this. If you say yes to this, you're going to absolutely lose it. Labour's getting deserted in Scotland. People are moving from no to yes. All the arguments we used before. I'm going to tell you, Boris, I want you to say yes. Mm-hmm. I actually want you to call their bluff. I've listened to all the arguments that are coming over, because you've got the right when you say yes to impose conditions. Here's the first condition. Because we know that a considerable number of people, let's say 30% of the people in Scotland, the sovereign Scots, don't want to break up the union. Be democratic, Boris. Make sure when you say yes, you impose a threshold of 70%. Mm-hmm. 70% of people voting in the referendum must vote yes. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And the second thing to do, when you wrote to Nicola in January and said no, you said, Nicola, you and Alex Salmond both promised this was once in a generation. Let's use that. Let's say if you can't get your 70%, you can't hold another referendum for a generation, and we'll define that, Boris, as, let's call it 30 years. Let's really force the Scots to think what their future's about. Give them a referendum. How do we deal with that? Chris, over to you.
Well, let's start with that final point on the generation game, which I find quite funny. How many UK governments, remind me, has there been since Scotland last had a choice on its own future? You had the David Cameron government, you had that government resign, you had the Theresa May government, then you had another Theresa May government, now you've got the Boris Johnson government. So, in political terms, I would say that three prime ministers and several UK governments is more than a political generation. From an events point of view, Scotland being dragged out of the EU against their will, the coronavirus, which is without a doubt the biggest event that's happened in anybody's lifetimes, these are events that mean it's completely reasonable to say to people in Scotland that, well, hold on, there's an opportunity here to reassess what people said in 2014. There's an opportunity here to look at the democratic deficits that have happened since then, whether it's things that we often forget about, such as another £205 billion in rising being invested in Trident nuclear weapons on the Clyde, so whether it's child poverty increasing, whether it's the Tories being in office when we were told there was the opportunity that Labour would somehow get into office, and then, of course, Brexit, the coronavirus, a plummeting economy, rising inequality. All of these things make it perfectly reasonable to tell people in Scotland that's a political generation and then some. And it's only right that we give the people in this country a choice on their own future. So going back to your former point, the first point about, well, what if Dominic Cummings says yes? Well, I don't think he will, but if he does, well, I'm actually confident that we can get upwards of 65 to 70% to actually vote.
We had a, Chris, you know, we had a threshold thrust on us before.
I know. So right. I think that the issue here is precedent. Alex Salmond established the precedent that actually also established that the people of Scotland had never given up their sovereignty. No sovereign people can willfully give away their sovereignty. What we did do is we gave away our independence. But
every version of this we've done, Chris, the one theme I run to is the people are sovereign. It's something I'll come on to later. Couldn't agree with you more.
So if they want to impose a threshold, then There's obvious legal routes we need to go down to, and political agitation to force the issue. That's, I mean, that happened back in the 70s. It was undemocratic then, it's undemocratic now. But the Edinburgh Agreement has established the precedent, and the UK government can't argue on one hand that they want to only allow a referendum with this Section 30 in line with what was established in 2012, and then change the rules because they're going to lose. And, you know, I think that one thing a lot of people in Scotland, including people that are undecided or perhaps just on the soft no side, won't like is Boris Johnson and some UK government telling us the conditions that we need to accept to have a choice. That's not self-determination. That's been locked in a box and been told that you can pick which route you want out of the box only when they tell you.
A lot of it, Chris, depends on how you spell the word evil.
Well,
right. And I see the machinations behind the power at Westminster. It's not Boris Johnson, it's other people. I don't regard them as friendly towards Scotland. Mm-hmm. And the reason I raised the arguments I've just raised is why I worry about Section 30. It's broader than that. That's my personal opinion. I'm going to ask you something later on to do with this. Can I bring in one other thing? Very simply, it's timescales that you're working to, right? Mm-hmm. Timescales, I'm going to orientate it in a particular way. Under Schedule 4, when Dave puts up the thing, you'll see Schedule 4. Schedule 4 deals with, the first two items on it are the Scottish Government are a lot like to muck about with, and they quote an act, the Treaty of Union of Scotland way back in 1706, and then the further treaty in 1707, and it then in matters of trade. Mm-hmm. Someone can correct me in this, because I've tried to find out if I'm right or wrong on it, but in EU law, as part of the withdrawal agreement, the EU said, right, you can have an extension if we're not getting through these negotiations. It could be 12 months, or it could be 24 months. But you're right to ask for that negotiation has a time limit on it. But my understanding is that time limit is July the 1st. So if Boris hasn't asked for an extension to the negotiations on by July the 1st, there will be no extension to those negotiations, which to me suggests that on that day, everyone in Scotland, and I'm not choosing the name particularly, just everyone in Scotland, which includes Nicola Sturgeon, knows we are going out of the EU, we're out of the EU, but we're most likely going for a hard Brexit, no deal. And yet 62% of Scots said, hang on, that's not what we want.
Yep.
If I were wanting to call a referendum, that's the day after the July the 1st that I would be doing it. But that doesn't fit in with the timescale you're going to have to work through for what you're trying to do within the SNP.
The real politique of the issue is that, I mean, people sometimes say that I'm just playing to the core in the gallery, but the reality is that I don't think you can have a referendum now or this summer, because I'm watching people, and I come from Inverclyde, where more people have died than any other part of Scotland. I mean, there's been five times more deaths here in Inverclyde, one of the smallest local authorities in Scotland, than the whole of New Zealand. So I certainly don't think it's appropriate. And I don't think that people have the appetite right now to go from a position that many people weren't actually allowed to mourn or attend funerals, and there's a lot of grieving still to be done, to jump right into a political campaign for a referendum. So I think we need to be sensitive to that prospect. So personally speaking, I think that now, obviously, the test is 2021 May for what we will manage to achieve at the ballot box. And if there is a potential referendum, if that's the route we're going down, I don't think that can happen until that campaign would then be after that election, and we'll be talking in the late summer, autumn, perhaps even into the spring of the following year. And I know that won't please everybody, but I would much rather win a referendum then than not win a referendum at all. But, you know, there's the, obviously, I don't know if you're going to ask later on, there is the live legal action that's currently going.
That was my next point, because again, it comes back to timescales.
Yeah.
We will know within a fairly short time how that action has resulted.
So that action is the start of a timetable they themselves have set out. And as much as I hope they're successful, I don't think it's a credible route map, because the action then is requiring the Scottish Government to almost immediately legislate for a referendum. It's just simply not going to happen. They're not going to do that while they're still dealing with the coronavirus, and then hold that referendum by November, I think. Again, the Scottish Government aren't going to do that. As much as I'm sure many independent supporters would want that to happen, it's not going to happen. So there's actually another issue then, because if you win that action and then you give the UK government, say, until next year, well, can they change the law that you've won the argument on? Potentially. So I don't know where that's going to go.
It'll make it clear one way or the other, but if Martin Keating's is successful in what he's pursuing, the one thing that I think the UK government's more or less obliged to do is appeal the decision. That's why I raised the question under timescales, because a lot of this seems to me to depend on what times are involved.
The UK Parliament set the law, so there's nothing really stopping changing that law, is there, if we don't manage to get a referendum held within a timetable that stops them doing that?
They've done it before by saying, OK, if you're thinking of something clever, and then they'll just rescind it the day before and say, you can't do that. And I went back to a discussion that you mentioned, Theresa May saying now is not the time. Mm-hmm. It was an interview that Nicola Sturgeon did on the Robert Beston show about that time. And what she was saying is, she was asked, basically, are you going to have a referendum? And Theresa May said no. And she said, well, I'd rather have it now, but 2018 or 2019. We're in 2020. Mm-hmm. We had an indication that before this year was out, we would have a referendum.
Yep.
I know there's a lot more going on. Brexit negotiations are still going on, Chris, despite the COVID thing. That is all happening, right? Mm-hmm. No one is stopping working in that. The civil servants, the negotiators, both sides of the channel are still working in that. And that's where your approach to Mike Russell, to me, makes complete sense. if we are intent on having independence in Scotland, we can't stop doing work in relation to it, and it's got to be visible to people.
Yep.
And basically, as far as I'm concerned, this time round it's got to be cast iron. You can't have just years quoted, right? You're saying May 2021. Fine. That has got to be absolutely cast iron. So I think you've got a hell of a job ahead of you. My worry is very simply is that you lose momentum in this, and it mustn't lose momentum.
Quite often when we're talking about independence, a lot of the people we're talking to are people that are converts or people that have always believed in Scottish independence. So they're always going to vote yes or whatever the question is to independence. But as good as that 54% poll was and the 52% poll before it, that was excluding don't knows. So when we factored in those don't knows, the people that were definitely the yes still went over the 50%. So I think we need an actual campaign, a positive independence campaign that sets out those arguments on pensions, on currency, defence, particularly the economy, and particularly post-coronavirus, because we've effectively got two choices now as part of the UK. Is it more taxes or is it more austerity? Now, I don't think the UK government are going to impose more taxes on rich Tories, so it's going to be more austerity. And of course, the other option could be that, considering borrowing's as cheap as it's ever been in many decades, they could borrow to invest so that we don't need austerity. But if they did that, they would be admitting that the 80,000 people that died because of their austerity policies died for a political choice, because they could have borrowed back in 2010 to stop austerity. So I don't think they'll do that either. So whereas people in 2014 thought that the economic arguments were a weakness for Scottish independence, and I think it was either this morning or last night I seen John Major saying that the prospect of independence has never been grimmer because of the economic arguments. Well, I'm not sure which economic arguments he's talking about, because we've got an opportunity now in a post-coronavirus world to start building a new nation. We can basically cut our ties from the UK, and the Growth Commission, as much as it was a very substantial piece of work, and I think Andrew Wilson should have been credited for the amount of work he put into it, doesn't mean you had to agree with it, because the onus was on other people to come up with alternatives. But I think we're now in a post-COVID situation that we can basically have no shared assets. We shouldn't be paying this £12 billion a year payment to the people of England as some sort of thank you for stripping our assets over 30 and 40 years. And by the way, here's a payment every year to thank you for not creating the sovereign oil wealth fund that now sits at something like $1 trillion, which the Norwegians are drawing down in so they don't have harsh economic arguments. So I think the world's moved on. Scotland's in a position that, you know, the unionists always like to remind you that the economy of a country is like your household budget. That's just not how you run a country. And maybe it's no surprising that successive UK governments have made a complete mess of running the UK economy by making that false equivalence. But we're in a position now that we can create a new economy. There's other political debates that we don't even have at the moment, because we're talking about the Plan B issue and how to become independent. But things like a universal basic income, it sounds an interesting idea. I'm certainly not someone that says, oh, it should definitely happen, or it shouldn't happen. I'd like to learn more about it. But the reality is, Scotland can't have a universal basic income if it stays part of the UK, because the UK government's never going to give people free money when it's got a Stivers versus Skivers attitude. And you can go across as many economic opportunities as you want that independence makes possible. And just, I'll finish on the economic point. You know, people were giving plaudits to the Chancellor with his furlough scheme to pay 80% of wages. He copied it from Norway. It was a Norwegian government policy, and we've since seen people like New Zealand, similar size of Scotland, same potential of an economy. They've invested much more of their GDP in helping people recover from the coronavirus, whereas in Scotland, we're now getting faced with the real proposition that people have to go back to work when they don't think it's safe to go back to work, or risk not getting paid, because the UK government furlough scheme is not a UK scheme, it's an English scheme. And as soon as the Chancellor thinks it's no longer needed in England, he's cutting that money in Scotland in July, and I've got a real fear that we're going to see that tsunami of redundancies coming. We're already seeing that in Shannon with Rolls Royce, British Airways, and that's UK economic policy absolutely impacting on the well-being of people in Scotland. So the wider point here was, this is the independence campaign. These are the campaign arguments we need to have, and we need an actual campaign body, a new Yes campaign, to actually make these arguments to pensioners, to make them to young people, to make them to students that are losing the opportunity to go and travel and study abroad, to make them to people that are actually seeing where universities are going to be underfunded because of the impact of Brexit, universal credit's going to be at a record high. There are arguments that we can make in every single community in Scotland on why Scottish independence is the best option for the people of Scotland, and it also gives them much better life chances. There are no arguments that unionists in a no campaign can go into every community in Scotland and make. They cannot go into a community in Greenock and say, vote for independence, vote against independence to get rid of child poverty, because under their watch, child poverty and inequality is at a record high. Are they going to go and sell that, oh, only if we vote against independence, we can't keep weapons of mass destruction? Yeah. Oh, only if you vote against independence, are you going to keep the pound? I mean, what does that even mean to people anymore when they're seeing the pound crashing? They're seeing that, you know, global economies over the world, the currencies are relevant. It's about the ability to have your own money in your own pocket and spend it in what you want to spend it on that actually will matter to people post-coronavirus. That's why we need a Yes campaign. And that, back to your point, is why we wrote to Mike Russell, because as Constitutional Secretary, it's his job to push on the constitutional argument. And he's doing his job if he does so. He's picking up the money for that as a Cabinet Secretary. He doesn't have many other responsibilities in Cabinet. So I think he should try and pursue the UK government. And before the 2021 election, he will get us to a position that we know categorically, going into that election, that the UK government said, no, you're not getting your Section 30 order. And that makes a difference to how we then go to the ballot and cast for vote. And it certainly makes a difference about what that vote will be counted for, and people will know it means.
When you're talking about Rishi Sunak, I noticed something this morning, like he's borrowed a further £120 billion, but Scotland's only been allocated £3.6 billion of it. So but the 8% of the £120 billion would be something near enough, £12 billion. We don't get £3.8 billion. Yeah. There's £8.2 billion of what they're borrowing on our behalf is what we're going to have to pay back, which is £3 billion more than they're giving us. And we're supposed to say, well, thank you, sir.
We're still paying off the dodgy deal that Theresa May done with the DUP, which Scotland never get any extra. I mean, never in my life did I think that the UK government would have been propped up with the DUP, but that's what happens when we allow a government we don't vote for to determine we're putting in. The irony, of course, was not only did we end up with a government then that we didn't vote for, we also ended up with a government we couldn't actually even vote for because it was in a different country.
Yeah. So to draw in a comment you made, Chris, when you talked about how people will react in Greenock to how things are going, the per austerity and the promises that might be made. Move a wee bit further down the coast to Inverkip, to the marina there. Because when you criticise the UK government for their economic policies, remember that there was a wealth gap created because of those economic policies. Not everyone was impoverished because of what they did. That is the main point I would come at. Now, I'm going to go back to my Schedule 5 for a second. I'm going to accuse a lot of people in Scotland of suffering from the Stockholm syndrome. We've been imprisoned and we think the way we do because we've grown up with bad habits. We don't rethink how we should be reacting to this. And I want to pick up on the sovereignty bit. Schedule 5 says the Scottish government has certain powers and we're reserving other powers.
Yep.
So it says, here's a door and it's the UK government that's got the key. You can only get through this door if we decide to let you have the key for a wee while. None of that applies to the sovereign people of Scotland. Nowhere in the Scotland Act does it say, if you are sovereign people, you have no right to do anything that we are forbidding your parliament to do.
Yep.
Now, we've not met before, Chris, but one of the things it says is you can't have a central bank in Scotland. We've got it. You can't have your own money in Scotland. We decide that. with the help of a lot of yes people, I asked people to put a pound coin in a bottle and sign a bit of paper saying they would back a Scottish currency. I then delivered those bottles full of pound coins into the First Minister of Scotland as a demonstration of saying, if you are a sovereign people and you're prepared to take action as such, not wait for other people to tell you what you can or can't do, not wait till you read Section 30, which tells the Parliament what it can't do. And that was my example of saying, look, you don't have to work to what the UK government are telling the Parliament it can do. You've got the absolute right to do what they are telling the Parliament it can do. Do it yourself. There's a whole bundle of things. There's certain things in Schedule 5, like immigration. I don't think the Scottish people can deal with that, but that's one of the areas where we know the economy needs immigration into this country. There are other things like finance and money where there are plenty of things to do. Gentlemen in the top corner of the screen at the moment, David, my old pal, the 12th Heed, is going to be the first person I'm going to invite to show how you can start a yes currency and how you can actually start to build a yes economy. Not because the UK government is refusing the Parliament the right to do that, because the sovereign people have the right to decide whether that's something that they need to do, irrespective of what happens at parliamentary level. You'll see that coming over the next few months, because for me, the things I'm raising about timescales, I took no part in the 2014 referendum. I then decided, having discussed it with my wife and saying, you know, when I commit 100%. I'm totally committed to trying to do this, but it needs this people who are in, who are sovereign in Scotland, not just to say, I am a sovereign person, but to act like one. That's coming, Chris.
Well, I definitely look forward to reading, looking at that, reading it, mate. I think one of the key points you made there was on currency. I think the world has moved on to a stage now that absolutely we should be looking to get our own independent Scottish currency as soon as possible after we become independent, because as I spoke about earlier on, with the record low rate of borrowing, the UK economy, is it really an economy that we want to stay linked to? Because a lot has changed since 2014. I mean, do we really want the Bank of England to have that sort of influence over Scotland's economy going forward? So a new Scottish pound, or whatever you want to call it, has got to be something that we achieve as soon as possible when Scotland becomes independent. And the conversation about Schedule 5 is important, because I think it also lets you go back and address that point in 2012. That
there's a whole bundle of people, Chris, that have worked in currency. You had the Growth Commission, as you've kind of pointed out. It's now out of date, and it had a lot of objections in it. Andy Anderson, I've travelled Scotland with and spoken at things. He's written books on the subject. You've now got Tim Rideout coming out. You'll know from the conference when there was a discussion in this, and he said, right, the tests set in the Growth Commission are not the right tests. Mm-hmm. I'm actually doing it from a different level. I went down to a small meeting in Ecclefechan, and I asked the people who were at it a very simple question, and the answers were illuminating. I said, right, is cash, you know what cash is, if you've got a pound coin in your pocket, you'll call that cash. Mm-hmm. Is that the same as money? So when you pull out a banknote issued by the Royal Bank of Scotland, who can run out of money, we've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. Is that the same as cash? And is cash and money the same as currency? Or is currency only when it involves international thing? My reason for doing that was that that's what I mean by getting right down to the basics within the yes movement. Because if you do that, it's actually possible. Commonweal did it. Andy Anderson's done it. Tim Rideout's done it. Growth Commission's done it. You've just done it, Chris. Which is, after independence, the world's our oyster in these things. We can set up what we want to set up. I'm doing it the other way. I'm saying, why the hell don't we do it now? And I can do it now. And Dave's going to be the first participant in it. We'll show you how you can start. I've called it a yes currency. That's the name I used, yes. The second for pence is please. Now, that might sound absolutely ridiculous, but the essence of any money is it's a medium of exchange. And if yes people can't trust each other when they go into a medium of exchange, That is a disaster for any currency.
You've got to obviously realise that what we're dealing with is the predetermined constructs of people over their whole life. So we really need to make sure currency is something they can simply understand. We can tell them when it will happen, what it will be, what it will look like. Because again, that was something that people maybe they used it as an excuse for why they never voted for independence, but it was certainly one of the reasons that they said on the doorstep.
Let me take you on to something that a person I spent time with, a person called Peter Bell, would bury Section 30. He thinks it's an absolute abomination. Mm-hmm. He worries about your plan, Chris, because it maintains a reference to Section 30.
Yep.
How would you react to someone that, there may be a lot of people who are of a similar mind, and I don't want Peter's thoughts on this to be just his thoughts. I think it's a lot of people thinking that way.
I would hope that people like Peter will stick with us, and I know they will, regardless of whatever strategy we pursue to achieve an independence. But I think that we established a precedent in 2012 that most people, mainly in Scotland, understand, and that was that they agreed the consented referendum policy. So I think it's right from the political point of view of getting popular support and keeping making our approach legitimate is that we try as hard as we can to pursue that, which we're currently doing. I think it's hit the mud, and that's why myself and Angus McNeill are now pressing Mike Russell to go and actually push the UK government on the Section 30 route, because if the UK government ultimately make it clear that the Section 30 route, so they're not going to allow a Section 30 order to amend Article 5 to devolve the power over holding an independence referendum, then that strategy just means that they've got the Boris veto or the Theresa May veto or whoever the next Prime Minister will be, because we might then get sucked into an election timetable that people think, well, actually, Keir Starmer might give us a Section 30, just like we heard in December. And I mean, I don't think that anyone was credible that thought the Labour Party would have won that election. But just because John McDonnell came up to the Edinburgh Festival and had won too many gins and said that he would be open to the idea, all of a sudden that was a natural part of our election strategy. And I think if you get to 2024, May 2024, and the Labour Party win the UK election, regardless of whether the SNP are in a position to influence that election, I mean, it's not a strategy to say we'll pray for a hung parliament, because you can't make that happen. But the UK Parliament has been run by the Tories since 2010, so the Labour Party really going to wait 14 years to get into power, and when they then get into power, instead of then going and pursuing whatever domestic agenda they promised, enter into a Scottish independence referendum? I don't think so. They'll sell us the same story that we're currently getting about now is not the time, and let's prove to you that self-determination isn't actually a thing you need to worry about, because we can make Scotland work within the UK. That's what will happen.
Let me give you another thing Peter Bell makes reference to. I raised it in a blog he wrote on, and so did another person. I agreed with her that it relates to international recognition of what we do in Scotland. Douglas Chapman was on one of the earlier videos we did, and he was on at a great length about the need to get international awareness of what's happening in Scotland. It fits into what you're talking about, Chris. When you're dealing with Mike Russell, I'm hoping that if you succeed in persuading him to start making moves in all of this, one of the things he'll do, not just with the EU, but the countries like in EFTA, maybe even broader than that, that he will be saying to diplomats, embassies, fellow politicians, look, here's what Chris and Angus have come up with. We're going to go down this road and we will ask for a Section 30, but beware, if that doesn't come to fruition, then next May we're going that way. One of the people that referred to that was another person we had on, David McGuinness, and he was saying in the Indy truck the other day, if you make known to the international community, Scotland will become an independent country. So when you're discussing your trade discussions with Boris, just be aware that Scotland will not be part of that trade entity. What I'm saying basically is, in pursuing what you're doing, Chris, and luck with it with Mike Russell, make sure that Mike Russell is also making sure that the international community are also aware of what we're trying to do. I think it's very, very important.
Yeah, fundamentally, if you want foreign governments to support Scottish independence, they've got to see the opportunities in it for them. But from the legitimacy point of view, if we can establish and then prove that the means at which we make Scotland an independent country is legitimate and the people of Scotland popularly support that, then international recognition will follow if they see that there is domestic recognition and legitimacy within Scotland. And how do we get to that position that the strategy and the route to independence is seen as legitimate and popular supported? Well, there's the political campaign. So groups like All Under One Banner should be encouraged to agitate politically to make sure that people understand and see what we're trying to achieve. There's the legal routes, there's the political routes through elections. And obviously then that crystallises in the 2021 election. These are all credible planks in how you get independence. And I'll keep coming back to the point that anyone that thinks it's undemocratic to suggest you achieve something at a ballot box, then what does that mean? What's the point of a democratic election if you're only allowed to contest that election on something other people agree with?
Do you view the emergence of other parties, ISP, the Alliance?
I will always, of course, advocate that people should vote SNP when they have an SNP candidate. And even when the SNP don't win a seat, we finish second in it, which means we're the most likely party to win every seat. But from a Scottish Parliament election in the constituency, the best way to achieve independence is voting SNP. And there's obviously a debate about the list. And that was a point I just started to approach earlier on, in that if the Green Party stand in this election and every Green vote, then we say, well, that counts as a pro-independence vote. Or the Solidarity, Scottish Socialist Party, Rise, Independence List Party, etc. But if the Greens are saying, well, we get independence with 1 million people signing a petition, or Rise or whatever other parties emerge, say independence is achieved through this route, and if all these different routes are different, someone could credibly say, well, actually, all those independence votes added up gives you 53%, but 53% weren't all voting for the same thing, because the SNP said it with this, the Greens said it with this. So there's got to be a grown-up conversation across the leadership of all the pro-independence parties to all agree a common route. I mean, we can have different domestic policies. You know, I will not agree with the Greens on some of the issues, particularly investment in roads, when I think we need more investment in roads to connect Inverclyde to Glasgow and not the rest of Scotland. But on the issue of independence, it's either an issue of you support independence or you don't support independence. So if we can all agree that we support and want independence, we should all be able to agree a common approach to that. So whatever the SNP, and I don't mean to be arrogant, but I think it's just the reality that the SNP are the largest political electoral force in the Scottish independence movement. So whatever the SNP determines its position, because I mean it's unsustainable not to have a debate now, so a debate's coming. So whatever we establish as our policy to take into the 2021 election, we should be approaching all the other parties and asking them to include that as their policy for achieving independence. And that means then that every single pro-independence vote can rightly be seen to be a vote for that strategy. And it's then a lot harder for the unionist parties, who all have different manifestos, but will all be united in saying no to a second independence referendum. They can't then say that every pro-independence vote isn't a vote for independence.
Coming down the road, there's going to be a committee of inquiry into what happened in the Parliament. Mm. That's going to involve a degree of tension. It's what I was referring to much earlier, political tensions. That is going to hit the SNP, I think, harder than the Yes movement. But in all of that, how do we make sure that the Yes movement doesn't lose its impetus? It's why I talked about giving guarantees, cast iron guarantees on a date. This date will not be changed. That's when, if that happens, this happens, we'll have a referendum. I worry at the moment that between now, because things will delay and delay, and a lot of other things go on that hit us, poverty is one of them. What happens with COVID's another. What happens with Brexit and maybe tariffs coming in for farmers, etc. All of that is going to be disruptive of holding a movement together. Chris, how do we do it?
It's got to be leadership. So when the Scottish Government, hopefully sooner rather than later, managed to keep the numbers of new instances and more importantly deaths down in coronavirus, it creates a space that people can start. As I said earlier on, you can't tell people that they can't talk about politics and the things that politics can achieve and the things that politics matters regarding, such as social care and education and bins and hospitals and police and law and order, all these things that are absolutely related to politics, including the constitutional question. You can't tell people they can't talk about that when they see people sitting in pub beer gardens and going to the cinema. The two don't add up. So as soon as we start to move slowly and cautiously out of lockdown, which we're currently doing, it is, in my view, now perfectly acceptable for people to talk about the sort of country they want to live in, because that materially is related to the coronavirus. As I said, the UK government are going to make two choices soon, and they're going to have two major issues to deal with. Of course, those choices will be more austerity or more taxes. Well, the constitutional question is linked to that, because if Scotland had control of those powers, we get to make those choices ourselves. And we're facing a massive, massive unemployment issue at the moment. 10% of the OBR's projected. And again, we need our own Scottish-specific levers to be able to address and deal with that. I mean, and if you think back to the, without being cheeky, saying that you were about at the time, but if you think back to post-war, when the NHS was established, but the level of debt the UK government had then was far greater than the level of debt now and far greater than the level of debt in 2008. But with that amount of debt, with the right political will, the NHS was created. So it's absolutely possible to go and create a positive society going forward now if the political will's there. So if you decide right now at this time, when the massive economic questions are about to be answered, this isn't the time for politics, then it's the politics of Boris Johnson that become the politics on the streets of Greenock, Dundee and Glasgow, because we were too scared to have a political conversation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Dave, how are we looking for time? Now is the time to start getting active and discussion on Plan A, discussion on Plan B and what they actually represent and their importance. That is a very, very essential, I think, pivotal discussion to take place just now. So
absolutely.
Can I thank you totally for coming on to be with us?
I really, really, really enjoyed it, and also...
This is a new voice for a new Scotland.